Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Latif Matema and Rob Peguero joining me, Denise Howell, and we're going to talk about the feisty aspects of the fair use doctrine and also the social justice ones. We're going to talk about the future of music and Amazon's role therein. We're going to talk about law and policy quite a bit and the role it will play, tech policy, that is, in upcoming elections. And we're also going to talk about a guy who might be taking this whole quantified self thing a bit too seriously, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 268, recorded July 25th, 2014. Ease up, dude. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and welcome back to This Week in Law. We're so glad you could join us. We've got fantastic guests joining us today. Don't get too discouraged that you're not seeing Evan Brown right away. Evan got stuck, unfortunately, today, couldn't make it, but we will see him again next week, hopefully. We miss you, Evan. We'll see you soon, but don't worry, because we've got two fabulous guests joining us today, both return guests to This Week in Law, and two of my favorite folks to have on the show, Latif Matema, from the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice at Howard University. Hello, Latif.
Hey, how you doing, Denise? Thank you so much for inviting me back. You know, I've always wanted to say that. I never got a chance to do either the Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin show, so this is the next best thing. Thanks for having me back.
All right. Well, I'm in great company there. It's wonderful to have you back. Great stuff going on that is in your wheelhouse that hopefully you can help us unpack and understand. And the same goes for Rob Peguero, man about the internet, currently at Yahoo Tech and still writing at USA Today as well, and law and tech policy guru, also in DC. You guys are just, you know, up the street from each other. So maybe after the show, you can wrap and go discuss it all over a more congenial kind of atmosphere.
Here.
Hey, Rob, great to see you.
Good to be back.
I know you've been bopping around to various events as you are prone to do, and I'm hoping to get some updates from you on them during the show, because it's very interesting, all the places that you go and help people understand the interests of consumers in technology and how policy is impacted by all that and impacts it. So we're looking forward to getting around to that. But I think that we will start this show this week with some copyright stories. So just to frame our copyright discussion today, for people who aren't familiar with the term or the doctrine, I thought we'd talk for a minute about the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice, Latif, and tell us about the intersection of social justice and IP, and maybe even start from square one and talk about social justice and why it's important.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things that sort of gets lost in certainly in the 20th century commodification view of intellectual property is that the intellectual property law, you know, it really functions as a very important social utility and social ordering mechanism. You know, when you think about what intellectual property is supposed to accomplish in a modern society, you know, on the patent side, it is to spur utilitarian innovation. On the copyright side, it is to promote artistic and expressive endeavor and work. in order to basically move our culture forward. Now, our focus at the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice is that, you know, what has happened and happened a great deal throughout the 20th century was that intellectual property was focused on primarily as a commodity, as, you know, an item that's sold, you know, for consumption, and its role in advancing culture was not something that was given its proper due. And as a result, a wide variety of social deficiencies that were related to the intellectual property regime weren't properly addressed. Anything from inequitable access to medicines and pharmaceuticals, lack of equitable access to knowledge and information, the digital divide, all of these things were important social deficiencies that were directly related to the intellectual property regime and the way that we look at it. And in, particularly in the digital information society, we have to be very conscious and very careful that the intellectual property regime, it's doing its job, that it is helping to make our society a better one, helping to move us forward, and not getting in the way of that. And of course, that's something that we see in the news every day. And in particular, some of the very excellent copyright cases and controversies that you've sort of like pulled together for us fit very well into that area of inquiry. You know, for example, one of the things that has happened recently in the field of copyright social justice on an international scale, of course, has been finally the adoption of the Marrakesh Treaty for the Blind. And, you know, as we moved into the digital information society, here we finally had the technological capability to render traditional books more accessible to the blind. But because of interpretations of the copyright law, both nationally and internationally, there were these legal obstacles to getting that done. The passage of this treaty is the first step in making certain that on a global basis, the blind and visually impaired all over the world will finally have the kind of access to books and information that everyone else enjoys, and that they'll be able to participate and to make their contributions to society the same as everyone else. So that is really what the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice is largely all about.
That's really cool. I was unfamiliar with the Marrakesh. Is it a convention, did you say?
Oh, it's a treaty.
It's a treaty.
Yeah. And in fact, this it's one of those moments in time in which the real world and international law all came together, because as this has been debated for several years now, finally at one of the WIPO meetings, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is an agency of the United Nations, and the Institute is happens to be an accredited non-governmental organization member of it. But at one of the meetings, which I unfortunately was not at, Stevie Wonder appeared. And Stevie Wonder made a promise to the delegates that if you finally get together and approve this treaty, I will come back and I will do a concert for WIPO. On the other hand, if you keep the stalling of this and you don't do a treaty, I'm going to write a song about awesome. Your inability. Yeah. And it did the trick. The treaty was passed, and now it has to be ratified by a sufficient number of countries. I believe India was the first country to ratify just a couple of weeks ago, and other countries are lining up. The United States has not ratified just yet, but we're hopeful. But as I said, this is like a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a really important step. Can you describe for us what it will accomplish? What intellectual property barriers are going to be taken out of play, and how someone like Stevie Wonder or a less famous blind person will now be able to enjoy digital media in an easier way?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the problems with copyrighted text is that, you know, as we know, what the copyright law does is that it provides certain exclusive rights to the copyright holder, to the author, for example. And one of those exclusive rights is the right to make copies. Another one is the right to make a derivative version, you know, to put it in a different format. Another one is the right to distribute it. So all of these things are things that can only be done with the author's permission. Now, if you take a traditional copyrighted text and you want to transform it into a format that is more accessible to the blind or visually impaired, you know, for example, putting it into, even traditionally, putting it into Braille, or in the digital context, digitizing it such that it can be scanned, it can be put into formats such that it can be used through audio formats so that it can be listened to, all of the different types of ways in which you could transform a traditional hard copy book into something that would be more accessible for someone who is blind or visually impaired. All of those things involve making copies, making derivative works, sometimes engaging in distribution. And so you can't do any of those things without the author's permission. Oftentimes, it has been difficult to get author permission. For one thing, it can be very, very difficult, as we know, in the modern copyright world, to identify who, in fact, actually has the copyright at this particular moment in time. In other circumstances, it might be difficult once you have identified who the copyright holder actually is at this point in time to obtain permission at a cost that is affordable, such that you can make the end product available at an affordable price to the blind and to the visually impaired. So what the Treaty of Marrakesh does is that it removes these many of these obstacles, and it opens the door to just taking these sorts of uses to transform them. It sort of just takes them out of the picture, takes them out of the realm of the exclusive rights and that sort of author veto power, and it enables countries to actually authorize entities and individuals to undertake this type of transformative work, to put it into different formats, put it into audio formats, and for this type of work to no longer be considered copyright infringement, you know, at the international level. Interestingly, at the same time that we were seeing this development on the international front, recently there have been some decisions in the Google Books area, one decision, particularly the HathiTrust decision out of the Southern District of New York, in which that was one of the central issues. A group of entities, universities and others, pulled together a corpus of books that were at universities and wanted to undertake their digitization so that in digital form, it would be much easier to put them into formats that would be accessible to the blind and the visually impaired. And when they went about to do this, a group of authors sued, raising the very exclusive rights that I just described. And fortunately, in that case, Judge Baer of the Southern District of New York ruled that that type of purpose fell squarely within the fair use doctrine, which allows individuals other than the author to engage in exclusive rights when it is necessary to promote an important, socially necessary purpose. So we're seeing progress on both fronts. So the Marrakesh Treaty is progress on the international front, and then this type of case like the HathiTrust and other decisions in Google Books, some of which we'll get to talk about later, we're seeing progress at the national level as well.
Yeah, that's really encouraging. Rob, is this something that perhaps you've been following in connection with your work with the Consumer Electronics Association?
Way back when, one of the first, so for listeners unfamiliar with this, I wrote posts about once a week or every 2 weeks for the Consumer Electronics Association's blog from 2011 to 2012. One of the first posts I did, which still holds up pretty well, it was around the time of the last batch of DMCA, anti-circumvention exemption requests. DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It says you cannot defeat a technological measure that effectively controls access to a copyrighted work, which is really kind of a pernicious bit of doctrine because it allows you to fence off all kinds of stuff behind this intellectual property wall that maybe isn't necessarily actually covered by copyright. And so Congress sort of realized that this thing might go off the tracks and set up a process where every 3 years, the Librarian of Congress and the Register of Copyrights get to come together and say, we'll give you these exemptions where if you break someone's digital lock, somebody's digital rights management restriction for this lawful purpose, it won't be a DMCA foul. And I just took a look at the last 15 years or so of this process, and it's so scattershot where you'd look at 1 year, they'd say it's okay to break DRM on an ebook to make it accessible to the visually impaired, but it's not okay to do the same thing for a DRM to movie so that somebody with a hearing impairment could get a closed caption version of it, which makes no sense. Either you want to make it accessible, and that's a good principle all around, or you don't. And so today, you know, there was one sort of case of Congress actually stepping in to fix a mistake. For a while, the DMCA's restriction on jailbreaking phones to unlock them to use them on another carrier, that was getting chipped away by the Librarian of Congress. And eventually, the last go round, the decision came back, forget it. For all new phones sold after this, we're just going to assume there are enough unlocked phones in the market. So if you've had your iPhone for forever, you can't get it unlocked no matter what. And a couple of people, one of them ran a business unlocking phones, got good and mad, got a petition up on the White House site that led to an unlocking bill, a bunch of unlocking bills getting put forth in Congress. And one of them has now passed the House and the Senate as of today. And so the good news is that'll reverse this decision and legalize unlocking. The bad news is in 3 years, we get to do this all over again as we get to the next round of DMCA anti-circumvention proceedings, which is crazy. Like, why would you... You know, the fact that you'd have unelected people making hugely important parts of copyright law with, you know, so little accountability is bad, and then have it keep happening every year. You would think if this is a legal purpose, you would sort of keep it that way instead of saying, nope, circumstances have changed. You can no longer unlock your phone or remove the DRM on a movie or an ebook or whatever else.
Right. This is big breaking news today. I'm over on Derek Connors' Twitter feed, and here he was obviously, he's been on the show a few times, and he was instrumental in getting this law publicized and passed. So he's very excited. And this is great news for folks who've been watching the cell phone unlocking bill that it has passed the House as of today. Where was I going to go with this? Where I was going to go with this is back to the fair use doctrine, I think, which seems to be expanding if you look at the reasoning underlying the Google Books and HathiTrust decisions that you were discussing, Latif, a moment ago. You wrote an interesting piece on Google Books and the social justice contract and what the decision means, what we can take out of it for the evolution of the fair use doctrine. First and foremost, before we go there, it seems like the fair use doctrine itself is a social justice sort of principle, an exception to copyright law that provides a defense to infringement claims. And it seems, you know, without delving too deeply into the legislative history, which I don't think we're equipped to do here on the show today, it seems like fair use definitely has those sorts of considerations in mind.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, as I said at the outset, copyright law, just like the rest of our IP law, it's a part of, it's one of the important social ordering mechanisms, right? We know that we need to have a thriving society. We know that we need people to think and to express themselves and to write and to share those ideas, because those ideas will inform and educate other people, and you'll have all types of wonderful fruit that come out of that. You know, oftentimes we think about the copyright law and copyrighted works as encouraging additional artistic endeavor. You know, I read a great novel and I'm inspired to write a novel myself, or to paint a painting, or to do a movie. But it also has an incredible impact on utilitarian endeavor as well. You know, the way in which a chemical principle or principle of engineering is described, is expressed, is written about in a textbook or a professional or academic article, that will inspire and inform the next generation of scientists and engineers. So a copyright mechanism is extremely important. And whereas on the one hand, you want that mechanism to provide what I like to call secular incentives to people to expressively, to creatively and artistically express themselves, because they always have non-secular incentives, right? You know, I sing because I must. Right, I paint because I have to, but the economic, you know, secular incentives is what the law addresses. But at the same time, you don't want that system to get in way of the overarching purpose of the copyright mechanism, which is to move the culture forward. And so you give the authors their exclusive rights, you allow the public to make use of these works in all other respects, but then you also recognize that sometimes important social objectives can only be addressed and satisfied if you allow the public to also engage in some of these exclusive rights that have been roped off for the authors. And that's where the fair use doctrine comes in. And so in a particular circumstance, you may want to make a copy of a work. You may want to distribute a work. You might want to make a derivative version of it, and if for some socially important purpose, and that's where the fair use doctrine comes in. I think that to bring it into the digital information context, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that both the copyright regime as a whole and the fair use doctrine, all of these things were conceived of in an analog world. And now in a digital information society, we have to rethink these things. We have to reimagine them in this context. There are things that we can do now with copyrighted expression, books, music, paintings, articles. There are things that we can do now that we couldn't do 20 or 30 years ago. And now that we can do them, we have to sit down and give some thought to, well, how much control over these new possibilities do we reserve to the authors and say, you're the only one who can engage in these new possibilities? And how much of it do we say, no, we're going to leave that open for everyone because it's important to moving culture forward that we enable the public to engage in these uses as well. And so a number of the cases, you know, that have recently been handed down by the courts. For example, there's the recent the White case, the republishing of legal briefs, making them available on digital systems such as Pacer. The court recently ruled that, yes, that is a fair use. In other words, what's happening here is we are going to transform the use. When it was written originally, the lawyer wrote the brief in order to make a particular legal argument in a particular case. On Pacer, we're making all briefs available such that everyone in the public will be able, first of all, to follow the public record. Other lawyers and judges can review these materials, learn from them, make new arguments, build upon them, which, of course, is the heart of our legal system, right? Everything is based upon precedent. This is something that prior to the advent of digital information technology, we were not able to do. I mean, we weren't able to make all of the briefs in all of the land available to everyone who had access to a computer. And this is an extremely important step of social progress, and this is an appropriate use of the fair use doctrine. And so, yes, the fair use doctrine is a very important social utility and social justice tool, provided one is interpreting the copyright law and the fair use doctrine properly and not improperly limiting it.
Right. When people come to me as a lawyer or as a host of this show, curious about the fair use doctrine because they've heard of it, they're inevitably looking for kind of concrete answers. You know, if I do this particular thing, is it going to be a fair use? And that, as an intellectual property lawyer, you just, you know, you don't run away from that question, but it's not something that you can ever answer easily because it's a very amorphous doctrine that gets applied all over the map by the judges that get to apply it. And for people who, you know, just haven't looked at it recently or have heard the term fair use and don't know exactly what judges are looking at in applying the doctrine, it has four factors. The first is the purpose and character of your use. The second is the nature of the copyrighted work. The third is the amount and substantiality of the portion of the work taken. And then finally, the effect of the use on the potential market. So you can see how with all those moving parts, you could, you know, crank something through the legal machine and get different answers depending on the analysis of the judge who's applying it. So what seems to be happening, perhaps, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Latif and Rob, is that judges are starting to recognize that a big part of what new technologies do is ease of access and distribution, and that perhaps that should be a big factor in the first fair use factor, the purpose and character of your use. If you're enabling ease of access to things, as we were discussing, legal briefs, the world of literature, things that societally are considered important for people to be able to view and analyze and access, that should weigh into the whole fair use calculus. And it seems like, you know, as you wrote about the Google Books case, Latif, that judges are starting to see this, and we're starting to see this come in more and more to various decisions. So are you seeing a trend there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's a very good, a very positive trend. I mean, I think the way that I try to think about it sometimes is that, you know, if you come up to a task, for example, you know, you look at a 20-foot hill and you've got to get over it. You look at it a certain way and you try to figure out the different angles. And the way you tackle it is very different when you're just looking at the hill or then when somebody comes up and introduces an 18-foot ladder. Right? I mean, now that hill looks different. Your options are different. What you can achieve and accomplish are different. And you really have to take into consideration the fact that with a ladder, we can do a lot more. And we can't be stuck in an old regime in which the ladder did not exist. You know, we can't ignore the fact that we have new capabilities. And how do we use these new capabilities to their greatest effect? What I see as a trend in the cases is that, you know, way back in the 80s, you know, we had our first sort of, you know, watershed moment in fair use jurisprudence. Judge Pierre Laval, who's now on the Second Circuit in New York, you know, wrote a famous article, you know, focusing in on the transformative aspects of the fair use analysis. In other words, looking at that first factor you described, asking what's the purpose? Why are you engaging in this use? And if your purpose is transformative, meaning you're going to use this work in a different way than what the author originally intended, that's kind of what copyright law is all about. In other words, we want you to build upon past works and take them to new heights and point them in new directions. And I've always looked at that as the watershed moment of sort of aesthetic transformation. Are you redirecting it to a new artistic or aesthetic purpose? In the digital era, the way I think about it is that the next plateau we reached was in the Kelly versus Ariba case. And there I've sort of looked at that as what I call functional transformation. And for those who aren't familiar with that case involved the thumbnail images of artwork that was already on the internet and on the internet for sale, et cetera, that sort of thing. And what Ariba did was they created an internet index of tiny thumbnail images of this artwork so as that you could go to this index and basically use it as a search engine. You know, find the art that you would like to buy, and then you would go to the site where the art was available, and then you'd be able to purchase it. And so this is functional transformation, right? In other words, the purpose of these thumbnails is not to provide people with the actual art. I mean, they're tiny. You can't really see the art clearly. You blow them up, they become distorted. No, they're not taking the place of what the original purpose was. It's a new purpose. It's a functional purpose to enable you to find the art wherever it happens to be on the internet so you could actually go and see it and acquire it. And I think this most recent fair use development or evolution in the cases, such as HathiTrust and the Google Books case, is I think what we're beginning to see is something I like to call socially transformative uses. In other words, uses that aren't exactly an entirely new function, but uses that do some of the work that copyright intends to have done, but isn't getting accomplished and certainly not being properly accomplished in given all of the options that you have with digital information technology. And so in the HathiTrust case, hey, you know what? Now that we have this new technology, it actually becomes not only possible, but feasible to make so many books available to the blind and the visually impaired. We can do it now. And in the analog world, and given lots of copyright legalities, we have not been able to do that. But we have the means. Great. What we're going to do is we're going to use the fair use doctrine to remove those legal obstacles and make it happen. And so I look at that as a socially transformative purpose in that line from aesthetic transformation to functional transformation. And now courts are looking at social importance and fitting that into the social doctrine, which I think is a major advance in the fair use jurisprudence.
Yeah, it's a nice trend to see. It assumes, though, that cases are actually going to come to trial or that enough will come to trial and go up on appeal, that law will get made and that judges will have the chance to sort of apply these new concepts to technology as it exists today. Rob, do you think in the era of content ID, for example, that's really happening as much as we'd like to see if we're going to see this trend continue?
The phrase I've had stuck in my head for the last few minutes has been, but Aereo, because in that case, the Supreme Court said, don't bother us with the workings of your technology. We don't care that you say you have a separate transmission of the over-the-air TV signal from the tiny antenna to someone's screen. Right. This looks like a cable company, so therefore we're going to find you guilty of infringing on the TV station's copyright, which is really, you know, if you're going to start judging new technology, this looks like something that's been around before. A whole lot of things get to be on really shaky ground, and a whole lot of services wouldn't have gotten to the point where they are today. I mean, look, the VCR itself was in that opening graphic right there. If you judge that on a looks like an existing copyright protected service grounds, instead of thinking, does it have substantial non-infringing use? Maybe the Betamax case gets decided a different way. And I sort of liked Judge Scalia's dissent in that a whole lot, saying like, look, sure, they exploit a loophole. That's what good lawyers do. If you don't like it, go to Congress to get it fixed.
Right.
Which, realistically, the broadcasters probably would have done had they lost. And so here I have to be not quite so gung-ho about it. Mm-hmm. Because, A, yeah, the big copyright, big content has a lot of pull in Washington. And also, I don't want to overlook the fact, fair use, the fair use defense, you have to go to court first to assert it. And going to court is not cheap. It's one thing for Google to be able to fight for its right to make new and useful uses of copyrighted material in books. They can afford to do it. But if it's, you know, two kids at Stanford University who want to have some new innovative service of their own that mashes up or transforms copyrighted material in a new and socially useful way, they're going to have a tougher time of it. You know, they won't have a whole legal department they can get to work on their behalf.
Right. So, you know, absolutely. Gotta, you know, plant your flag and fight when, that's available to you.
One other point in the area of defense, one of the closing parts of Justice Kennedy's opinion was, well, you know, we realize we set a fuzzy standard, but if it's really a problem, the companies that are sued, they can assert fair use. But yeah, that's I don't think that's the slide you can really have in your pitch deck to venture capitalists. Well, if we get sued, we'll assert fair use. That's right. Where they go on to the next startup.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one quick thing I wanted to add is that, I mean, I agree with you 100%. And I think that one possible positive takeaway that one can take from all of these cases, and of course, you know, Aereo is troublesome in some respects. On the other hand, Aereo wasn't a fair use case. So it leaves us some room, you know, to shape the fair use doctrine a little bit outside of that. And I think that one of the things that we can do with this is to say that, you know, when I think of these types of cases, you know, I kind of get this image of the old Henry Fonda Grapes of Wrath, you know, movie, you know, which, you know, here it is, like, this was my farm. And, you know, I planted and I've worked it for 20 years. And I'm standing on the edge of it with a musket. And anybody who comes here, you know, I'm just going to protect it. And, you know, it's plant and shoot. Right. And, you know, when you think about the 20th century author, there's that kind of mentality. You know, this is my book. This is my content. And according to the law, I have absolute say over it. And anybody who comes anywhere near it and tries to take a piece of it or do something different with it, I'm ready to shoot. And I think that not only is that an incorrect view of the law, that's not exactly the way that the copyright law works, but it's also a view that disserves authors as well. I mean, there comes a point, for example, in the Grapes of Wrath context, in which, you know, you're defending a piece of the Dust Bowl. Right. I mean, you and your family are starving. It's really time to move on and to do something different. And, you know, your overarching purpose in surviving and thriving is no longer being met by clinging to this outmoded business model, you know, if you would. I think that what the fair use cases do is that it presents to both authors as well as the established content industry that, listen, we're going to begin more and more to take these social utility and social justice obligations in mind in making these decisions. Now, it's very expensive. It's very expensive for everybody, whether you are a rights holder or using public, to battle this out in court. But now that we've kind of re-leveled the playing field, we've let you know that if this gets to court and it ends up being resolved, these social issues are going to be taken into consideration. Maybe this will enable you on the author content holder side to begin to get out in front of these digital issues for content. And instead of approaching these new possibilities from the Grapes of Wrath standpoint, I don't care what it is, I don't care who you are, I don't care how important it is, I'm planting and I'm shooting. Instead, it gives incentive to say, you know what, maybe we ought to rethink this. Maybe instead of trying to step in front of the digital application train, maybe we ought to start getting in front of the issue and welcoming these uses and, you know, coming up with collaborative proposals and ways in which we don't have to fight about this. We can work together and everybody can benefit, everybody can profit, and most importantly, these progressive uses can move forward and move forward without the pretty much just the lawyers making a lot of money.
Love the Grapes of Wrath metaphor and the Dust Bowl. It's just fantastic. Let's talk about a couple of specific instances where people have made it into court. We've been talking about Google Books and the HathiTrust case. We touched on the White case. We should let people know that what was decided there, if they didn't catch this in the course of the discussion already, was that legal briefs, what someone had argued, the plaintiff in the case had argued, was their lawyer's proprietary intellectual property, their legal briefs that they'd written on behalf of a client. And again, I'm not quite sure how the lawyer would have all the copyrights there if the briefs were written on behalf of the client. But I think what happened in the case is they didn't get too concerned with the enforceability of the copyright or even the question of infringement. Infringement was either presumed or found, and then the fair use factors were applied. What happened was the question was whether it was fair use for legal briefs to show up in the Lexis and Westlaw databases, having been taken from Pacer. Which is a Pacer is a pay service, right? I haven't used it in quite some time, but I think it's a subscription service where you can get access to all available digitized public records from courts. Is that right, Latif? Am I getting Pacer accurately defined there? What happened is, yes, it was found that infringement had taken place and that the lawyer who had written these briefs had a protectable copyright, but it was fair use for them to be in the database. Do you want to unpack how the court got there for us, Latif?
Well, I think that you pretty much summed it up. I mean, the court looked at the four fair use factors. Considered that the first factor was satisfied in that this use was transformative. And, you know, as we discussed a little bit at the top of the hour, this was utilizing the brief for a different purpose, not to advance that particular legal argument in that particular case, but to just make it available to other lawyers and other people who wanted to read the public records. And, you know, you could review it and build upon it, you know, that sort of thing. And the nature of the work, it was considered to be largely factual and functional. In other words, this is a work that is focusing on specific legal principles, you know, rules of law. This is not the same thing as a novel, you know, which you've created elaborate characters. The amount of the work that's being used, well, when we get to the amount and substantiality, there's a rule in the cases, in the case law, that, yeah, although we don't like it when you use the whole thing, but if the nature of the use requires you to use the whole thing, then we're not going to weigh that against you, right? And when you're talking about inclusion in a database, well, it's got to be the whole document. I mean, it can't be part of a brief. Otherwise, it's of no use to anyone. And then lastly, the impact on the market for the work. There was no real contention that this was affecting the market for the work. It wasn't as if this lawyer, first off, he had already, you know, had already used it for that purpose, right? He'd already been paid by his client, et cetera, et cetera. And there was no indication that he was in the I'm going to resell my briefs to whoever would like to buy them market. And so when you look at it, it satisfied all of the four fair use factors. And then, you know, when you sort of approach it as a gestalt, you know, the whole overarching effect, it's like, hey, okay, you know, should we, now that we have the capability to digitize briefs and make it possible for lawyers, law students, individual public citizens, people who want to defend themselves pro se, when people want to sit down and take a look at the law, you know, you read a case, you see that the case was decided a particular way, well, you realize that there were two sides arguing, well, you might want to take a look at the arguments that the winning side made to see, ah, okay, you might want to take a look at the arguments that the losing side made to see that, well, here's an argument that they did not make. Maybe this is why they lost. So now that I have the same case in front of me, I'm going to make this argument and see if I can distinguish the existing precedent. So these are all important social utilitarian and to some extent social justice uses. And, you know, once again, a sort of a paradigmatic example of the fair use doctrine at work in the digital information context.
Right. And the interesting distinction between this White case and the HathiTrust and Google Books cases we were discussing earlier is that unlike Google making things available freely, you can search and find things freely using their service. Lexis and Westlaw are very much pay services, you know, with small exceptions for law students and others. So even though the commercial interest here, someone was profiting directly off the use of this work, it still was found to be fair use under these factors.
Yes, and that's something important to keep in mind. When we're looking at that first fair use factor, if your use is commercial, that is something that a court is going to keep in mind. But the mere fact that someone is going to profit from something that is otherwise socially important, that really needs to be done, the court is not going to, in effect, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because you can think of many a use in which someone is not making any money, but it's not going to be considered a fair use. I mean, for example, if you write a wonderful new book and everybody wants to read it and you're going to get great sales, if I, just because I'm mad at you, Denise, and I don't want to see you get that summer home, so I make a copy of your book, I digitize it, and I just send it out to everybody in the world so is right. that you won't make a dime. Well, I'm clearly not going to profit from that. I'm not going to make any money off of that. But a court is not going to accept that as a fair use. There's nothing transformative about it. I'm just basically taking your book and giving it to everyone. And it obviously is not going to satisfy the fourth fair use factor. It's clearly going to have a devastating impact on the market for your work. So that's something very important to keep in mind, that the emphasis is on the social significance. And yes, the court will look at whether or not this use is commercial in the first fair use factor, but right. that will not be an automatic death knell.
And before I get tons of email on this point, allow me to clarify, I was not meaning to suggest that while Lexis and Westlaw are a commercial kind of entity, Google is not. Of course it is. It just doesn't charge for access in the way that the other two do. Another interesting case involved using photos on a blog. And it's always nice to get some guidance for what people are out there doing when they're blogging. Of course, people frequently will grab a photo and use it to illustrate a blog post. And sometimes, you know, if they have not consulted with a lawyer and what Blogger really does every time they post, they have some sort of understanding that, gee, if I'm doing commentary on this, that I'm probably okay. This one involved, and Eric Goldman has a really funny blog post about this case. It's called, let's see, what's the name of it? Levy Film versus Fox Sports. And it involved the novelty rap song, the Super Bowl Shuffle, sung by members of the Chicago Bears football team. Professor Goldman takes a nice little pop culture trip back to the 80s and can't believe just how bad this song actually is.
I hope we're not getting the song stuck in anyone's head.
Yeah, no, I intentionally did not put the video in the rundown, so I don't think we'll play it. Of course, those who are old enough to remember it, I think, are already hearing it in their heads. The issue in the case had to do with using a DVD cover depicting members of the football team doing jazz hands, as Professor Goldman points out, and to illustrate that there was a lawsuit filed about the song. And there, unfortunately, whoever put the picture on the DVD didn't do a very good job of making sure that they had the rights to do that. And the person who had the copyrights in the photo actually sued this blogger over her post. And once again, we had a fair use decision that decided that the nature of her use was not going to be a problem here, and that there was no impact on the market for the photo and the amount taken. Again, going back to that Kelly versus Aribasoff case we were talking about before, the court focused in on not reproducing an original quality copy of the photo, but instead used a copy of the photo that was publicly available on the internet. Well, that you can think how that reasoning might impact other cases with so many photos of things publicly available on the internet, but not necessarily the full high definition original. So another interesting fair use case and some good news for bloggers. Rob, any thoughts on this as someone who no doubt illustrates posts with photos all the time?
No, I was thinking about that a while back. I was doing this post and I wanted to feature, it was after some school shooting, something unfortunate like that. So I thought, I'll write about a non-controversial topic, gun policy in the U.S. And I thought I'd illustrate this not owning a gun with a picture of the cover of this George Pelicanos crime novel that involves guns a lot. And I thought, well, let me just sort of artsify the picture I took of the cover of this book so that it wouldn't look exactly like it. Because I figured, well, you know, I mean, I've met Mr. Pelicanos. I think he'd understand, but I don't know what kind of lawyers he has on staff. And a lot of people, they don't do that. They simply grab the album cover art, bingo. And yeah. Did I do a good job with that?
You did. Well, for those watching our video, we're seeing Rob's post and the photo he took. A nice
and
way to go about that, by the way.
I strongly recommend reading The Sweet Forever. It's a great novel.
To both take the photo yourself, so you know that you're the photographer, you have the rights, and then to do something to alter the original. What do you think, Latif, of Rob's fair use steps?
How much do
here?
I owe?
Latif, are you with us? Oop, you might be muted.
He's adding up. It's going to be a steep bill, I think.
Let's see. Did you hit a mute button or maybe something automatic happened because we're not hearing you? Well, we'll get Latif's audio back in a second, but another interesting fair use development. And this would be a good time. Yeah. This would be a good time to put our first MCLE passphrase in the show. And it's going to relate to the next thing I'd like to discuss. Just a quick take on this next thing, which involves something that was posted to Reddit and the Supreme Court's very well-known Feist decision. So we're going to put feisty as our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We obviously have been going deep on the fair use doctrine today with a very esteemed law professor helping us out. So we think there's some educational value to what we're doing here. And if you think so too and would like to get continuing legal education or other professional credit for the show, we have some information for you at wiki.twit.tv. Find This Week in Law there, and you'll find some more information if you work in a field where getting continuing education is a thing you need to be concerned about. So we put these words in the show so that you can demonstrate to any oversight body that, yes, indeed, you did not just write down the name and title and guests of the show, but you listened or watched. Let's see. Latif, are you back?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay,
so
great. Yeah.
I was wondering if you had a take on Rob's steps in photographing the book cover and putting it in his post, particularly in light of this legal decision we were just discussing.
Yeah, well, two things. One, I'd say he did a great job because I think the copyright in that image would be very thin. I mean, it's basically just a picture of a gun, right? And so the fact that he retook the photo, you know, he, of course, is the copyright owner. And there's really not a whole lot, you know, in the photo. It's like a picture of, like I said, it's just a picture of a gun. The other thing that comes to mind is, you know, these types of issues, you know, little quick images that you pull off the internet and show it on a blog. Yeah, for me, it comes under the EUD rule of copyright, what I call ease up, dude. I mean, you know, it's like the image is already out there on the internet. And, you know, you could put a link in your blog and says, hey, would you like to see a cool illustration of this or a cool relevant photo? Follow the link, right? Well, why should you have to do that? Let's just put the photo, you know, right next to it. So I think these all fall under my EUD rule.
And I guess the judge in that Super Bowl shuffle case agreed, saying, look, it's already out there. This is not depressing sales of anything.
Yeah. Right. So I'm putting in one final copyright story for us here today that was from Evan's Twitter feed over the last week. Too bad we could not be here to get his, have him totally unpack what was going on in his head. But there was a story that was going around. It was written up at The Guardian. And if you're a Redditor, you perhaps had this hit your radar without reading about it elsewhere. It was a guy and a girl. They're married. I think they're married. Yeah. And the gentleman part of the relationship was unhappy with the amount of adult personal interaction the two were having. So he did an Excel spreadsheet and started keeping track of exact times where adult interpersonal relations were requested by him, but turned down by his wife. And he was getting a little frustrated and sent it her way. And then she posted it to Reddit and many discussions about the state of interpersonal marital relations ensued. But, you know, of course, Evan reads this and doesn't see the gender divide or any sort of he said, she said kind of conflict here. He sees copyright. He sees, well, she took his copyrighted spreadsheet and posted it without his permission. You know, he could probably DMCA the thing. So I thought it was, you know, funny for one thing, interesting for another, and an example of a trend that we see often, and that is where somebody may have what's really more of a privacy interest. That no particular privacy law might be available to address, or maybe there might be privacy laws that would address it too, but that copyright might be dead on point and more practical to use to take something down. Any thoughts on this, Rob?
Well, to me, this is almost, it reminds me of the whole right to be forgotten debate, because once that's out there, the second that is in any public space on the internet, trying to make it go away is like, you know, telling everyone in the room, don't. The first thing you're going to think of is a trunk, big ears. The husband there, I think, you know, I would say from the start, maybe you're taking this whole quantified self thing a little too far. And you should, don't fire up Excel. Go talk to a marriage counselor or something. But then, yeah, maybe you'd want to keep this in, I'd say keep it in paper form, but she might have scanned it in. Who knows? I don't think copyright or any legal tool is going to solve this any better than that guy in Spain who is now going to be thought of forever as Mr. Right to be Forgotten.
Right. Mr. Right to be Forgotten. I like that. Latif, what do you think about Evan's point or Evan's musing, wondering if the data in the spreadsheet would actually have enough originality to be copyrightable?
Yeah, this is another one of those, you know, like the picture of the gun. Maybe a little bit more so. It may have a little more, you know, originality to it, but the copyright is going to be really very, very thin. I mean, all it is a collection of facts, right? And you don't get copyright in facts, although I don't know that these are the types of facts that you actually want to share, but okay, somebody did it.
No, they're not. And,
right, exactly, you know. And it's organization. There's nothing creative about the organization, right? It's this happened on this day of the week at this time, this hour of the evening. So it's questionable as to whether or not there's going to be any copyright protection. And if it's there, it's going to be extremely, extremely thin. This, for a whole lot of reasons, is a copyright infringement case that I would not want to take into court.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a whole lot about money in the next part of the show in various ways. Money in business, money in politics. How about money in your bank account, though? We're going to help you out with that right now because we're going to share with you a free and secure tool called Personal Capital, and it solves two of the barriers to growing your wealth. The first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of. You have stocks, you have 401ks, you have bank accounts, you have investment accounts, and they're all on different sites with different usernames and different passwords. The second thing that makes it difficult to keep track of your personal wealth is that you pay someone to manage it, and you're probably paying it too much. So Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets together on one single screen on your computer, phone, or tablet with real-time and intuitive graphs. And recently, Personal Capital announced the integration of its award-winning app with Android Wear, available for download in Google Play. The Watch app seamlessly integrates with Personal Capital on other Android devices and provides users with relevant and timely updates on their finances wherever and whenever they need it. Personal Capital shows how much you're overpaying in fees and how to reduce those fees. You also get tailored advice on optimizing your investment. Why should you wait, really? Especially with all of the wearable devices that are there for you to be able to keep track, know if you're paying too much, know what you've got on hand and how to maximize your investments. Signing up takes just a minute and it'll pay big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions right away. So you want to set up your free account right now. Go to personalcapital.com/twill. It's free and the smart way to grow your money. Thank you so much, Personal Capital, for your support of This Week in Law. Rob, I know you've been running around with a wearable as we speak. I think you're even wearing one right now. What do you think? You're trying to determine what the social mores and etiquette around all that is. How about checking your stocks and seeing if you're paying too much?
Yeah, it's funny because it's okay to look at your watch, although not always. Remember, it was George H.W. Bush in that debate with Bill Clinton and Ross Perot, where he was looking at his watch at the wrong time and people thought, oh, this guy's bored being in this town hall and having to answer common people's questions. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think if the alternative is looking at your phone where it's obvious you're in someone else's, you've tuned out of the conversation, then it's an upgrade. Yeah. If the alternative is wearing Google Glass and having this computer on your head, people don't seem too keen on that, even though the whole idea that you're going to sneak up on somebody and spy on them when you have a computer strapped to your head doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I don't know. I think it does help to just be able to see that, you know, instead of hearing my phone beep or feeling it buzz, I can actually see what the subject of the email is and determine that, oh, you know, it's not. It's a press release. I don't need to read that. No need to worry about that.
Right.
That may make me a slightly nicer person. I think there's a safety advantage. Like the best defense I ever heard of Google Glass was Matt Honan's piece about wearing glass for about a year or something he wrote in Wired a few months ago, where he noted that if you're on a bike, it's really handy to have the directions right in front of you. And I get that because I've been on bike share in DC and it's totally not practical to break out your phone to look at directions, but this thing will actually call out directions for you. And so that's pretty good. And this way, I may have to take one hand slightly off the handlebar, but it's not like I'm trying to grab a phone, hold it up while I'm going down the street. That's an upgrade. What I'm not clear on is distracted driving laws. You know, if they're written that specify using a phone, could this be legal, even though it's maybe not such a good idea to be driving around like this? I don't know. That I've got to talk to a few more people to see where the story is going to lead me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point because it's hands free. You know, you're not holding it, but it is viewable. So maybe they'd be treated like those dashboard screens.
Yeah, but which are okay, but can be distracting too.
Yeah, and are regulated in what you can put up there. So I wouldn't be too surprised if, you know, once lawmakers start realizing that people are running around with things on their wrists that do more than tell time, that we see a little bit more proactive legislation. Let's head on over to Hollywood and think about music and athletes for a moment. Music athletes and what we're buying when we buy stuff. Recurring themes, all of them, on the show. Amazon is doing some interesting things with its Prime Music and rejiggering the way the music industry is thinking, or being made to think in this instance, about licensing its catalogs. What Amazon did with Prime Music, and Rob, you've probably been paying closer attention to this than I have, is it's offered a service that goes along with, you know, yet another benefit of being a Prime member, is that you'll have access to both streaming and downloadable music, but it won't be a very deep catalog of music. It's since it's just a sort of free add-on with your Prime service, you're not going to get everything that you would get in a service you're paying for separately. And they've approached their licensing with the music industry accordingly, wanting to do some micro-licensing of catalogs that has ruffled some feathers and been something certainly that's not the norm. Rob, why don't you first tell us if you have an impression of Prime Music, what you think of this whole strategy?
Yeah, so I haven't really spent any time checking out the service itself, which is dumb because I pay for Amazon Prime and I should be making better use of my subscription instead of just having random stuff dumped on my porch on 2 days' notice. Yeah, I'm not surprised that they would sort of take that approach. It is kind of funny, though, for them to be this conservative. When they launched the Amazon Cloud Player in 2011, their whole attitude goes, we're not going to bother getting licenses because we think it's legit. And if you disagree, you can go take us to court. Then they did take out licenses for that, which sort of changed how that particular product worked. Yeah. On the other hand, that's just occurred to me is, and I was about to look this up, a million songs doesn't sound like much, but how many did the iTunes store have when it launched? I think it was less than a million. And we've all become so jaded. And in some ways, it reflects how, you know, you go back like 10, 15 years or so, and you ask somebody, what do you want out of digital music? They would have said, I want to be able to listen to a song for free and see if I like it. And if I want to buy it, I want to pay a dollar for the song and have it in some form that works on any device I own that can't be taken back from me because the DRM gets shut down. That's what we have. And it's amazing how far along the music industry has gotten compared to, say, movies or books where everything is cluttered with DRM and your free access is really limited. And, well, as a result, I spend more money on digital music than I do digital books or digital movies.
Right. There are a few interesting components of the Prime Music service. I mentioned that the music was downloadable. It's downloadable in what's called a tethered fashion, which, as I understand it, means that your downloads will be there while you are a subscriber to the service. And should you cancel Prime, your downloads somehow, I don't know if it's like a Mission Impossible self-destruct or how your device.
Tethered download is a phrase that hasn't been in use in a while. The very first truly awful digital music services, things like MusicNet and PressPlay, you would pay a monthly fee, which would give you streaming access, and you would get X number of tethered downloads a month. And if you stop paying for them, they'd go away. It's almost like a caricature of your music service, as if you ask the writers of The Onion, can you concoct the worst possible music service? And this was like the big record label's idea of what people would want. It was supposed to be them responding to Napster. When instead they were basically telling people, go to Napster. That's the only place you're going to get the music you want in a usable form. Now, in this case,
I don't think that's what Amazon's trying to do here. They're not trying to replace Spotify or Pandora or even Napster in its current iteration. Is there still a current iteration of Napster? Someone was asking me that yesterday. Rob, do you know?
Where are they now?
I know they did a paid service.
All about that one.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still around. Maybe someone in IRC will fill me in. But anyway, it's definitely, I think, a good driver for sales of the Kindle Fire and the Kindle Phone, that you buy this device and you're going to have some music that you're not paying anything extra for, that you're going to be, you know, you're off somewhere on vacation.
But there's so many different choices. You know, you can, Spotify is great for sampling stuff, seeing whether or not you're going to like it. Pandora, if you sufficiently creative with your music selections, you can pay Apple or Google for an on-demand music streaming service as well. So, you know, I think that's something that makes Prime a little more valuable, but not in the sense that, for instance, like Prime Video, having video on demand for free, that I do use a lot. Like, I've been slowly making my way through the first season of Betas. Good little look at the Silicon Valley startup lifestyle. And that's something that, A, I can't get anywhere else, and B, you know, that's a good addition to the package. That, you know, there's movies you get for free that sometimes are not actually available on Netflix. So I think that's a more interesting addition to the Prime bundle than Prime Music is.
So I'm getting conflicting reports from IRC. Rodeo 90 says that Rhapsody merged with Napster. And then Web3476 thinks that Best Buy bought Napster, but apparently, oh, here we go. Napster has joined Rhapsody. Thank you, Victor. So I don't know. I don't know if Best Buy is involved in that somewhere too. But the other interesting thing about this is the way it's approaching licensing based on its kind of unique business model. Latif, do you think that this is an innovation for the music industry and one that they're ready to embrace or should embrace?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea because, you know, I'm definitively old school when it comes to music. There's very little music that has been produced after 1980 that I've gone out and purchased. So as a result, you know, I fall into that group that I can spend a lot of my time and do spend a lot of my time listening to vinyl and to CDs. And part of the reason is that, you know, as new markets evolve and new business models evolve, they oftentimes don't pay enough attention to people who listen to the not forefront genres in terms of popularity. The micro licensing, you know, approach I think is a really good idea because, you know, it's a way to pull in people who aren't listening to whatever is the latest top of the charts piece of music. I'm a big fan of jazz. And, you know, if that's what you're interested in, well, you can just buy CDs from Amazon because it's not as if this music is being widely played or widely listened to. I think the other great thing that it does, again, to pull in segments of the population that aren't really being focused on in terms of new digital models is that, you know, in the analog world, you bought an album and it was yours, or you bought a CD and it was yours, and you didn't have to pay again and again and again. There was no monthly service fee, one flat fee, that's it. It's yours until it wore out, and then you bought another. And if it didn't wear out, then, you know, you're good to go. One of the good things that I think this micro licensing approach can do, particularly for people who, again, aren't listening to, you know, whatever the top 10 songs happen to be, is that if you take a category, like I said, that I'm interested in, you know, jazz, now let's see, I can buy, you know, tons of jazz CDs, but I'll never be able to buy them all unless, of course, I join a micro licensing subscription in which, in effect, I'm paying to have access to all of the jazz CDs in a catalog. And, you know, given the fact that, you know, the way that we listen to music now, it has really been transformed over the last 25 years from copies, you know, being able to play individual copies, and instead just being able to have access to the content. You know, eventually everyone is going to have access to content. It's just going to be a question of which service you're plugged into. And as you can freely trade and exchange back and forth between, you know, different services, well, this is just going to make sense for everyone. And, you know, you'll be able to have access to the micro license subscription that has every possible song in that genre that you would ever want to listen to. And you don't have to buy new CDs every year. All you have to do is you just got to continue to pay your subscription fee, and you continue to get new stuff, and you continue to have access to the old stuff. And the more interchangeable the various subscription systems become, with less and less DRM, you know, controls, then people can trade and share and exchange pretty much, you know, the way that we did when we relied on tangible copies and said, hey, yeah, here, you can listen to my CD and let me borrow yours. So I think all of this is boding well and showing that the music industry is moving in the right direction.
Wow, I hope Pandora's listening, because what a great addition to their service that would be. if you could just subscribe by genre. You kind of can now. I mean, obviously you're creating stations there and they're feeding you things that are like the things you seed your station with. But it's not quite what you were describing, and they need a shot in the arm. It sort of seems like that would be a great way to, I think, bolster up their service.
At Pandora last summer, and I said, you know, have you ever thought about having some sort of local thing, like playing music that's not just in the indie rock genre, but is from the DC area? And they said no. And I think they're sort of leaving some money on the table, because certainly, you know, I think locavorism isn't just good for your stomach. It's good for your head as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an option there. A lot of smaller indie labels, I mean, your average huge record label, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. The fact that so-and-so is signed to Columbia Records doesn't say a heck of a lot. But if you know that some band has signed with Discord Records, a really good indie rock label around DC, then like that already makes me more interested in them. And there's got to be an opportunity there, maybe, for these smaller record labels that have a defined kind of taste and that mean something to offer access to their own artist's work on that basis. I think in a lot of cases, it just involves go to their website, play whatever samples they have there, and it doesn't go beyond that. But that's one thing you can easily do, which you couldn't have easily done back in the day when, I'll be dating myself here, if you wanted to hear what was new in jazz around DC, you'd listen to WDCU 90.1, right, Latif?
I'm originally from New York, so.
it was a jazz station that was originally Georgetown's on campus station, and they sold it to UDC for a dollar to, I guess, make the city government happy. And it was a really good kind of jazz blues station for a while. And then DCU sold it off to C-SPAN when the city was having some hard times. And it's now C-SPAN Radio when you really need to jazz up your commute in a whole different way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sort of the opposite end of the spectrum.
Well, I'm glad you raised it, Rob, because that's been one of my pet peeves since moving to DC back in the 1990s. I've not been able to find a good, you know, regular terrestrial jazz station. I always have to wait until I'm back in New York, as I am frequently, and listen to WBGO out of New Jersey. So I'm sure folks who listen to that are going to be thankful to me for giving them the plug.
All right. Well, when you're listening to radio or you're listening to something streaming, you don't really assume that you have ownership rights over what you're hearing. Maybe you've paid a subscription for the privilege and maybe not. But when you quote unquote buy a book or buy a piece of music, you often, even if you're erroneous in this conclusion, think that you do have some kind of ownership right. Rob, you just wrote about this week at Yahoo Tech. In the wake of Amazon announcing Kindle Unlimited, which is an alternative approach to its Kindle service, where instead of buying individual books, you pay $9.99 a month and you get unlimited access to something like 600,000 titles, which might be a very nice solution if you're someone who reads a lot, because you're going to pay $9.99 pretty much for just about any Kindle book, or at least, you know, a couple of them. So why don't you give us your take on the whole state of owning your media?
Yeah, so this is an interesting case where you have two things intersect. One is that if you buy a Kindle book, you don't really own it. I believe the fine print still says you've obtained a license to the content. And, you know, Amazon has set up their DRM in a way that you really don't notice it. It's probably the best run DRM system out there, in that they've shipped Kindle apps for everything, not just Android and iOS, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. They ship one for Palm's WebOS, which, you know, I'm sure they regret spending the development cycles on that, but they did. They have an HTML5 web reader that'll work in Linux and any modern browser. So it's really hard to run into the boundaries of their DRM. But you know it's out there. You know that you can't loan a Kindle title to a friend. You can't resell it. You know, you own it, and then when you pass on, then it's gone. And you don't have the issue with physical real-world books. So
can't you lend Kindle titles now? I thought they added that.
Oh, the lending library thing is really limited. The publisher has to say it's okay, and you can loan it, I think, once a month or maybe it's once ever. It's sort of like, yeah, they have lending in the narrowest sense possible. Now, many of the things I describe also apply in movies. And so in that case, my decision has been to pay Netflix. And it's clear I'm not buying anything. I'm paying a rental fee, and that gives me on-demand access, and that strikes me as a fair value. I didn't get that sense with Kindle Unlimited, mainly because the selection is so bad. I went through and looked at the top 10 fiction and nonfiction titles listed by the New York Times, which includes some really older stuff from like a year or two back. And I think one of them was available on Kindle Unlimited, some self-published title. Then I just looked at 10 titles taken at random off my own shelves, and none of them were available on Kindle Unlimited. Then I looked at the DC Public Library site. They use the Overdrive system to provide ebook loans, and I did better. I think it was a total of, six fiction titles, six nonfiction titles were there. The catch is I could not have borrowed them because they were already out and there was a long list of people who put them on hold. So my conclusion was Kindle Unlimited will not work if you want to read a particular book. If you're just jonesing for something to read, sort of like if you walk into the Blockbuster at 9 o'clock on a Friday night in 1996, just give me something to watch. Forget my shopping list. Just what do you have? But if you're in that state of mind, let your tax dollars go to work for you. You've already paid for it. Borrow the ebook from your library. Don't spend the money on Amazon service. And it's funny that this is not included in my Prime membership. And so, yeah, I don't think I'm going to – I've got the 30-day free trial, and somebody remind me to cancel it before the 30 days are up. Otherwise, I'll get stuck.
Yep. That's always the hook of those. Latif, what do you think about buying versus owning media these days?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the things that the content industry really needs to get its hand on, and it looks like it's moving in the right direction in terms of some of the adjustments that are being made insofar as digital rights management systems are concerned, is that we really need to get to a place in which users have the same sort of incidence of ownership, same options, same capabilities with respect to the digital copies of their material that they had insofar as analog, you know, is concerned. I mean, basically, when you purchased a copy, you could do anything that you wanted with it. And your only limitation, of course, was from a practical standpoint, a technological one. You know, it wasn't easy to make multiple copies of your copy of War and Peace, right? I mean, that was the reason that you didn't. But you could loan it to whomever you wanted, resell it, mark it up, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that we really need to take some more technological steps because the capability is there. And to make certain that, you know, renters, basically users, that they can do with their digital copies everything that they were used to doing with the analog copies. And I think we all know that, you know, what was the stumbling block? Well, the stumbling block was if you can do whatever you want with it, then pirates can get a hold of it and then they can do tons and tons of things. But if we go back to what we were chatting about before, that pretty much everyone is shortly going to have access to everything, meaning everyone is going to have some sort of subscription service that they tap into. You know, today, I don't know very many people who don't use a DVR to watch television, which means we're all paying for these subscription services. We all have access to on-demand, and nobody's really thinking about getting a pirate copy of this movie or that movie because you know full well that in, you know, a couple of months, if not weeks, that movie is going to be available in your subscription service. You're paying for the service anyway, so I'll just wait and I'll watch it then. So I think that a lot of the DRM limitations on digital copies are ceasing to make sense. This, in turn, means that you'll be able to do all of the things and more with your digital copy that you could have done with your analog copy. And at that point, you know, access makes a good deal more sense than physical ownership or traditional ownership.
Right. But you would qualify that by saying as long as you have at least similar access to your digital goods as you would to the physical ones.
Exactly. And the thing of it is that, you know, the when you think about it in the digital context, you know, what would have happened but for copyright industry piracy concerns is that you would have gone from an analog copy in which what you could do was somewhat limited by the physical world to a digital copy that meant you could do everything you could do before plus. And what got in the way of the plus was, you know, digital rights management. But I think that when you move to a society, which is where I think we are, if not 100% there, we're maybe 70% there, in which everybody has access, everybody's paying for access to some subscription system. Everybody has a digital library. And so the fact that the copy in your library does not have a DRM on it doesn't really matter, because you aren't going to be sending it to anybody. You aren't going to be, you know, engaging in some, you know, unlawful use, because the guy next door, he's got a copy of the same thing. Or you get to a point in which, well, maybe what I have in my subscription is a little different from what you have in your subscription. But the fact that we can exchange easily is why we each have subscribed to the respective micro licensing system that we have chosen. And now, you know, the content holder, it has everybody. We're all plugged into it. We're all, you know, and this is not going to be, it's not going to be as good as my other analogies. We're all wiggling up to their trough, right? We're just drinking from different spigots. And, mm-hmm. you know, as the trough owner is concerned, hey, I don't care which end you waddle up to, as long as you belly up to the bar.
Right. Rob, you flagged something interesting and posted it to Twitter from authorearnings.com, looking at book author earnings. You said, wow, they really buried the lead here in the July 2014 author earnings report, which pulls data for nearly every ranked ebook on Amazon's thousands of category bestseller lists. And way down in the article, they talk about how DRM is actually still hurting sales. How does that jibe with the fact that we're all becoming more accustomed to sort of lightweight DRM that allows us to do everything that we want to do with our media?
Well, in my case, and maybe I'm just kind of a nudge about this, but I am a little bit picky. And I, mm-hmm. when I was writing this Yahoo tech post, I thought back to when iTunes had launched, and suddenly it was convenient that, yes, I could buy just the song I wanted. I could buy an album without waiting for it to show up in a store, order it off Amazon. I'd save money, but it would come with DRM. And, you know, it wasn't going to be an issue on my own Mac or on my iPod. But what if I bought someone else's phone? What if I wanted to listen to it on a computer running Linux or something that doesn't run iTunes in some form? And that would make me reluctant to purchase. I'd think, you know, okay, I'll save this option for things that aren't like really high value purchases. I compared it in the column to in the 80s, you know, if I was on the fence about a song or about an album's worth, I'd buy the cassette. If I was sure I'd like it, I'd buy the CD. And with ebooks, it's sort of the same way. I'm thinking, if I'm probably going to want to read this multiple times, if I think it's going to have lasting value, I'm more motivated to get the paper book, even if I may only read it once. And it's just the sort of extra bit I have to process when I'm thinking about it. And if, on the other hand, I see an ebook doesn't have DRM, and I'm not going to have to worry about Amazon not just shipping a Kindle app, but updating it and making sure it's feature competitive, I don't have to worry about it. It's a factor I don't even need to put on the spreadsheet anymore. And so certainly if you looked at my digital music consumption on iTunes, it went up a lot after iTunes Plus became the standard and there was no DRM to worry about. With Amazon MP3, I never had to worry about that because everything on there, it's high quality MP3, no DRM. It'll work on any device I own. There's nothing to worry about. And the folks at Author Earnings found that that was the case with independent authors. The funny thing is, it's really hard. There's no search option on Amazon to say, show me stuff without DRM. Yeah. You sort of have to search for something like DRM free, and that should get across most of the stuff they have. Not necessarily. And this is something that's bothered me for a while. I did a post for the Washington Post about 3 years ago complaining that A, you know, a lot of authors don't know that they can opt out of DRM. B, you can't even tell. You know, if you know that O'Reilly Media sells their technical books without DRM, that's great. But it's not super obvious from Amazon's presentation of that. And so in that sense, we have a broken market. If it were really obvious that, you know, in the same way Amazon notes how many pages the book has, whether or not it has DRM, which is kind of a big deal, it would be interesting to see how those sales trends might further tilt towards DRM-free titles.
Yeah, I can say just anecdotally, my dad just published a book through CreateSpace, Amazon's publishing platform. And I know in going through that process, it was never overtly made an option. Do you want your book to be DRM'd or DRM free? And I assume that the default is that it has DRM, and I'm definitely going to get in touch with him and tell him, hey, it's hurting sales. You might want to take out the DRM if you can at this point. Let's talk about athletes for a moment. There was a big settlement in a case that we've followed over the years as it's been unfolding, where EA was sued in a class action lawsuit about using the images and likenesses of various NC2A athletes. Huge settlement, over $60 million expected to impact quite a few athletes. I think over 100,000 athletes are going to benefit from this. And I know that the last time we had you, or one of your last appearances on the show, Latif, we talked about athletes being sort of at the cutting edge of civil rights developments. Mm-hmm. And this kind of plays into that, I would think, as well as the whole question of whether NC2A athletes are going to unionize to be able to negotiate rights issues for themselves. What do you think of the settlement and the state of NC2A unionization?
Yeah, this is a very, 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 very positive development. I mean, if you took a look at right of publicity jurisprudence, you know, just even say 5 years back, the picture was extraordinarily different. I mean, pretty much what was going on at that time is that when you had these right of publicity versus unauthorized copyright type uses, like, you know, the use of someone's image in a book or more aptly a video game, you know, what courts were doing is they weren't really doing any kind of analysis at all. And they certainly weren't doing any kind of right of publicity analysis. And definitely they were not doing any kind of IP social justice analysis. It was pretty much, okay, you know, we've got a right of publicity interest on one hand, we've got a copyright interest on the other hand, because this person is using your image in a new copyrightable work, i.e. a video game, for example. And, oh, there's also on that side a First Amendment interest because they want to express themselves. Well, First Amendment, that adds the thumb on the scale. That side wins. And that pretty much was the way that it was working. And then, you know, a very small number of us in academia and a couple of lawyers that are practicing in the field, you know, began to get some arguments before courts, both in law review articles and in specific cases, that really tried to get the courts to think about this somewhat differently, and to first of all just take notice of the fact that the United States Supreme Court, in the only time that it has issued an opinion on the right of publicity, had already said back in the 1970s that just because someone has a copyright interest, and indeed even a First Amendment interest, meaning in that particular case, it's a Zaccarini case, it was literally a news reporter that did a story on someone's novelty act. And yes, there was a copyright interest there. And yes, there was a First Amendment journalistic interest there. But that does not automatically outweigh the plaintiff's right of publicity interest. And in that case, the plaintiff's novelty act was that he shot himself out of a cannon, and which is interesting enough, but that doesn't give you, the news reporter, the right to take his entire right of publicity interest and say, hey, I'm going to tape the whole thing and put it on television because this is First Amendment and I want to talk about it. I want people to know about it, which meant in turn that the plaintiff could no longer charge people to come and see his act because everybody had already seen it on television. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the plaintiff, Mr. Zaccarini, the man who shot himself out of a cannon. What we've seen over the last 5 years, very slowly, very tediously, is that courts have begun to look at these issues and to see that, first of all, right of publicity is every bit as valid and every bit as important as the other copyright, as the other intellectual property, including copyright interest. It is a right to be balanced against the First Amendment and not automatically dismissed because someone raises a First Amendment challenge. And most importantly, and this is something that I emphasized in my articles various lawyers in some important cases, we also have to look at who some of these right of publicity plaintiffs are. And in the last couple of opinions that have come down, the Keller case and the Hart case. There's also a very recent case involving Michael Jordan. Courts have noted the fact that, look, what we have here is this is not simply amateurism, right? These are billion-dollar entities, you know, from the universities that supervise these teams, to the television broadcasting companies that broadcast these events, to EA that produces video games. Basically, these are entities who are making billions of dollars off of these individual athletes and making use of their talent, making use of their skill, excuse me, making use of their personas, and everyone is making money except for them. And, you know, you really have to weigh that into the analysis. And when you begin to think about, you know, some of the other issues from the head concussion issues in NFL sports to the fact that the so-called scholarships that students get these days, most universities configure it as 1 year at a time. So you'd better not get injured before your fourth year. These are really unconscionable bargains, and that the intellectual property interest of the athletes on the right of publicity side, they really were just being misappropriated. So I think all of these cases that have begun to find one after another, you know, the Hart decision in the district court went against the athletes, and on the appeal, it was reversed. The Keller court was in favor of the athletes, both at the district court level and at the appeal. The recent Michael Jordan case went against Michael Jordan at the trial court, and on appeal, you know, has been reversed. Courts are beginning to get it that, you know, your individual persona, your style, your skill, your athletic capability, these are parts of you. You work very hard to develop and to turn that into something that is merchandisable. And the fact of the matter is, everyone else should not be able to make money off of it and make billions off of it while, you know, you, the individuals running up and down the court, are told, be happy with this scholarship that we have given you, and that's it. So I think this is where a number of us are very pleased to see this moving in the right direction, and it's having impact all across. You know, an attorney I used to practice with back when I was at Kudir Brothers, and who's now at Manette, Ron Katz, he and I worked together on these types of cases, and he recently achieved a monumental verdict in excess of $20 million for retired NFL players along some of these same issues. And we're just seeing, one by one by one, this ocean liner turn, and I think this is just something we're very happy with.
And it might be good, since we started the show with a discussion of fair use and talking about legal briefs in a database and how somebody considered them their intellectual property and the fair use doctrine was applied, why this is a different kind of situation, why someone's mm-hmm. name, likeness, and you know the characteristics that make them a recognizable athlete, why the fair use doctrine wouldn't apply to someone like EA.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is that, you know, first, in the copyright cases, you're only dealing with one doctrine, right? You're dealing with the author of a copyrighted work and then the user of that work wanting to engage in a copyright use. And some copyright uses belong to the public and some copyright uses belong exclusively to the author. And the way that you balance that conflict, that tension, is that the copyright law includes the fair use doctrine to resolve those cases in which someone who is not the author wants to engage in a use that normally belongs only to the author, but they want to do it for a socially important purpose. And that's how we deal with that exception in that context. In these cases, we're dealing with two different areas of intellectual property. We're dealing with copyright on the one hand, the fact that, well, I want to tell a story. I want to tell it in video fashion, and it's going to be the story of two teams playing against each other in this animated game. In addition, I have a certain non-IP First Amendment right that is implicated. On the other side, however, we have an equally important intellectual property right of publicity, that also serves some important social utility and social justice functions. What it does, it encourages individuals to develop their skills and to develop their talents. It also makes it possible for individuals, particularly from marginalized communities and rural communities, but anyone, any person, who may not have access to the tools and the materials and the finances to engage in other kinds of intellectual property endeavor, to develop the one thing that they will always have, their talent, you know, their skill. And so what we have is that we have a different social balancing equation, right? And the same sort of social balancing analysis that you might undertake in the it's only one area, copyright, and so what will we do to look to fair use to balance these competing interests? For many years, the courts hadn't really worked out a workable balancing mechanism when you had these competing interests in terms of copyright versus right of publicity. And the problem was that there was no social balancing taken into consideration at all. At least in fair use, you would sit down and you'd look at the author's rights, and then you'd look at what the user wanted to do, and you looked at, well, what's in the best interest of society and fair, meaning fair use, to all of the copyright constituents. In these copyright First Amendment on one hand versus right of publicity on the other, there was no attention being paid at all to the social utility or social justice interest on behalf of the right of publicity plaintiff. And that's one of the most important distinctions. And what we're seeing now is courts actually balancing the two, looking at the respective interests, actually assessing, okay, what's the social utility issue at stake on the copyright side? What is the real First Amendment issue involved on behalf of the defendant? But now let's balance it. Let's take a look and see, well, what are the plaintiff's right of publicity interest? And let's balance the two. And the courts gradually began to introduce various judicial tests. There's the Rogers test out of the Third Circuit. Is the Comedy 3 test out of the Ninth Circuit. And all of these tests are designed to look at what's happening on the copyright side, look at what interests are at stake on the right of publicity side? Are you just using this person's picture and name and slapping it on a box of something and selling it, you know, somebody's face on a box of pancakes? Or is there something more involved? Are you transforming this image? Are you adding things to it? Are you making some sort of statement? Courts have begun to get in to do the hard work and to actually use these tests, actually apply them to the facts. And I think that's what the key difference has been.
Thank you so much for helping us understand the differences there. And it is a big development. We'll continue to follow the fate of collegiate and other athletes being used in video games and otherwise. But before we wrap the show, we've been talking about lots of issues and how the law comes into our personal lives and our uses of technology and how technology impacts us on so many levels. And, the folks in Washington make so many decisions about all that. So I think we should not end the show until we talk a bit about policy and then get on out of here. So a couple of interesting developments lately. Of course, we have elections coming up in the fall and then a presidential election looming on the horizon. And I wanted to talk to both of you, since I know you both pay attention to this issue, about the role of the policy issues we've been discussing today, the kinds of issues we've been discussing today in these elections. Do you think that people are actually starting to pay attention to these kinds of issues as they select their candidates? It's interesting to see that we have in New York right now two very tech policy savvy folks running for governor and lieutenant governor, Zephyr Teachout and Tim Wu, both professors, Columbia Law professor in the case of Tim Wu, someone we would very much, have loved to have gotten on the show. That's this is the first time I could say that there's a lieutenant gubernatorial candidate running somewhere who's someone, that would have been a good fit for our show. So I think this means something. What do you think it means, Latif?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, ever since the SOPA, PIPA controversies, we've begun to see the public not only becoming more engaged in intellectual property policy issues, but more aware, better educated. And I think that that is just absolutely, absolutely critical. I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that are not working about our current Democratic Republic system. The lack of progress in terms of our IP law and policy is certainly one of them. But I think that, the disconnect has been for some time that average people have not been able to make the connection between, what they're doing in Congress vis-a-vis IP and IT law and policy and how it affects me, as an individual, my ability to work and to play and to learn and, to just be a thriving individual in a modern society. The SOPA and PIPA controversies changed that. It broke pending legislation down into something that those of us who were involved in highlighting it and criticizing it and raising public awareness, that made it accessible to the average person and say, well, this is how it's going to affect your ability to utilize the internet. This is how it's going to affect your ability to set up a website and to start a small business and engage in entrepreneurial activity. And I think that was really what made the day. I mean, it's one of the few instances in our modern political society in which, major lobbying interests were not able to just automatically carry the day. The public actually rose up and spoke in a unified voice and said, listen, we see how this is going to affect us as people and as citizens and as human beings, and we don't want that, okay? And your job is to protect our interests and protect your constituents. So I think that these, you know, this is a public that I think is not going to go quietly back to sleep. I think we have to continue to make certain that these issues receive appropriate spotlight. And I think that those of us, be it academics or IP activists, people, you know, all of us, you know, all three of us here and others listening, we have to continue to make certain that the issues are boiled down and the focus is kept on it and that the information is accessible, that people really understand, you know, how this policy direction is going to affect you as a human being. I think as long as we can continue to do that, we can continue to keep a watchful eye and sort of keep our hands on the wheel in terms of which direction these things are going to move in.
Right. We'll keep our hands on the wheel and we'll look at whose hand is in what pocket. There's a lot of attention being paid to the role of money in politics when it comes to IP policy right now. Rob, you mentioned earlier in the show how ridiculous it is that these hard fought for DMCA exemptions that get reviewed and approved and decided they're a good idea, that they expire in 3 years and then you have to go through that whole process again. I think it's probably pretty safe to say that lobbying and the role of the DMCA and the functions it's designed to accomplish have a lot to do with that process. The fact that certain things that should sensibly stay in place expire and then you have to start all over again from square one. And if anybody is curious, I hope that you've heard of Mayday.us by this time. I know we've mentioned it on the show before. We need a second MCLE passphrase, so let's make Mayday.us our second one for this show. Jot that down if you're listening for continuing legal or other educational studies. And what Mayday.us is all about, it's a super PAC. It was started by Professor Lawrence Lessig and others, and its goal is to get money out of politics. And how that ties in with the IP and tech policy discussions that we're having is there are some large lobbying interests that have traditionally been able to chart the course of where the law has gone and how restrictive it has been and whether it has taken into account some of the other uses that we've been discussing today and the way technology and our approach toward technology evolves over time. And if you're in need of a guide for how this all ties together, there's a great article at motherboard.vice.com. I take it that's the motherboard blog at vice.com, written by Sam Gustin, that connects the dots directly between the Aaron Swartz story and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how it itself can be abused, and the evolution of this PAC and why Professor Lessig is fighting so hard to have a PAC that will support candidates committed to reform, financial reform in politics. So, Rob, I know you pay a lot of attention to these issues, and I wonder what you think of the Mayday.us success. They've raised over $7.7 million at this point and will definitely be a factor in upcoming elections.
Yeah, I mean, that's Latif had an important phrase earlier, which is, how did this affect me? If you look at how SOPA got stopped because people saw this bill as something that would throw up fake error messages on the web when they went someplace because somebody in Hollywood said so. Phone unlocking got passed because people thought, right, I paid for this thing and then I can't unlock it because somebody says it's not my property. Patent reform, which is a huge mess that hasn't gotten fixed. And part of it is trial lawyers did a very good job of getting in Harry Reid's ear. But I think it's not so obvious that because you have this law that lets you basically say, I invented this when you didn't, you know, taking credit for other people's work, basically, it's objectively bad, but it doesn't have that direct effect in your pocketbook. You don't realize that it added, you know, this much to the cost of your phone or your tablet because of money spent on pointless patent litigation. And what Professor Lessig is doing, it's the same sort of thing where you know that all these stupid laws get passed and you know that you sense that the system is rigged, but how do you fix it? And, you know, I wish him luck because I think he's correct that the influence of money is a big problem. It's not the only one. I'd look at you know, how state legislatures get twisted to draw rotten district boundary maps every 10 years. My own congressman's district, it looks like some sort of animal, not a gerrymander or a salamander, but something like that. And so there are all sorts of games that politicians can play to minimize the input of their constituents. And yeah, I hope he does well. I don't know how much money I want to bet on him doing well.
Well, I love his, as just a footnote to this discussion and people getting frustrated with their lawmakers being on the take and making decisions that might not be in their constituents' best interests, but in the best interests of the people who have been paying them. Over at the Washington Post, Christopher Ingram has an article pointing out how Darth Vader is polling higher than all potential 2016 presidential candidates. I don't know who gathered this data, 538.
He's a decisive leader. He gets stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. Luke Skywalker apparently polling the highest with Han Solo and Yoda running close on his heels. Even Boba Fett is doing pretty well, but it's way, way down. You know, you get to negative approval ratings when you get into all the actual people running for office, and Congress, the lowest of them all. So clearly, there's a lot of dissatisfaction out there.
And you know, I would
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add that, you know, I think that to pick up on Rob's point and to tie it to the question of dissatisfaction, you know, and people just not having the opportunity to see, you know, well, why am I in this particular bind, or why are things affecting me in a particular way? Rob raised a point about patent reform. You know, one of the big issues that everyone is talking about right now, depending upon which side of the issue you're on, you will refer to it as the problem of patent trolls, or you will refer to it as the problem of patent assertion entities. And that sort of gives away, you know, where you are. And it's certainly an important discussion. And we certainly have a break in the machine that needs to be fixed. And that's a important part of the patent, you know, reform, you know, puzzle. But one of the things that doesn't really get discussed very much in that debate is, for example, let's take the inventor from the historically marginalized community who doesn't have access to the resources that other inventors might have access to. So you struggle for years to work your idea out. You struggle for years to raise enough money to actually get a patent. You get a patent, but then you can't get the finances or the loans or the financial support to actually commercialize your invention. And so you're sitting there with this patent that it took you years to develop your invention, years to get the patent, spent, you know, $20,000, $30,000, and now you can't use it because no one is going to invest in you. And then one day someone comes up to you and says, listen, maybe I can help you out. Okay, you sell it to me, or you assign certain rights to me, and you're going to make some money. And when someone infringes upon your patent, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to fight for you, and I'm going to make sure you get your due. Now, that's a scenario that I think most people would not consider to be, quote, a patent troll. But depending upon how you define the situation, that scenario would fall into the patent troll fix. So that's not to say that you don't have individuals and entities out there abusing the system who are genuine, you know, patent trolls. But this is just another example as to how it is so important that everyday average people from real communities have some opportunity to really understand what's at stake, who are the various stakeholders, who are the potential constituents, so as that these voices and these concerns get incorporated into what the ultimate final solution to these sort of problems actually end up being.
Well, we've been talking about the people who govern the country and the role of tech there. There's obviously a clear role of tech in the internet. And Rob, you recently attended the Internet Governance Forum and talked to the people that govern the internet and moderated a session there called the Policy Slam.
It wasn't quite as exciting as that name would make it sound.
It sounds pretty darn exciting. Right. I watched the summary from Marilyn Cade, and the takeaways there seem to be bringing scientists and engineers into net governance, that's a good enough job's not being done of that. Exactly what we were just talking about, what Latif was just talking about, mainstreaming awareness by educating users about the benefits of participating in things like net governance, and also highlighting the net as a tool for freedom of association and access to information, coupled with the idea of benefits and risks of online identities, privacy and speech, or conduct-chilling concerns. Did that accurately kind of sum up what you guys discussed? Is there more to throw in there?
Yeah, I'm looking through the notes I'd taken. That there were some discussions, proposals that didn't get taken up in as much length. The guy who runs NetChoice, Stephen Del Bianco, he wanted to make opposition to the right to be forgotten a key point. And I think maybe if we'd have this discussion 5 days later, when it would have come out, I guess in just the last day or two, it turns out the geniuses running the EU's right to be forgotten policy have sort of noticed that the internet is a global thing and that Google has chosen not to expunge search results from google.com. And they see that as a problem. I see that not as a bug, but as a feature. And yeah, once you decide that certain things should just not be shown, well, logically, you have to make sure they're not shown anywhere on the internet. And in this case, it's based on a right that is not recognized in the U.S. If you did something, you know, stupid online, your cure for it is to do something non-stupid that will hopefully rise up in Google search results. And that's not how the EU sees it. So I would devote a little more time to that. I thought there were some other, Andrew Bridges' point about defending freedom of assembly was a good one. And noting how, you know, in the U.S., we are not without blame. There have been a lot of secretive domain name seizures done as, what is it, civil forfeiture, where in one case the feds took some hip-hop blog's domain name, didn't tell anyone about it for 6 months. It finally broke on techdirt.com. And that's something that more attention should be paid to that. If you can take someone's domain name, make the site unfindable online, that is every bit as bad as taking someone's car or printing press, anything else you would use to get information out to the broader public. And yet that happens. It just happens. And every now and then we read about it after the fact.
All right. Well, we've got some great tips and resources for you, very much in keeping with what we've been discussing today. The first is from Victor in the studio, who pointed out, as we were talking about Amazon and DRM and the role of DRM in Amazon's current business strategies, is that over at comixology.com, you now have DRM-free backups available for all of your digital copies of comics. I take it these backups are at Amazon, right, Victor?
It's actually not all of the comics. Some of the publishers, one of them being Image Comics, which is a big one, like, you know, the Walking Dead stuff is on there. Mm-hmm. So like Marvel and DC is not on board with that yet, but it's Comixology recently got bought out by Amazon, but it's through the Comixology website, and basically you go to your purchases, and then right next to it, if there is a download for it, you will have a little icon there saying you can download it in either PDF or the CBZ format, which
really
is portable
nice
to
featured
a lot of other apps or something like that.
Yeah, great DRM free feature to have for comic book fans out there. Denise now waves down south to Comic-Con, which is going on about an hour south of where I am right now. and Rob had a great tip in his USA Today column that had to do with making your Android device find your iPhone if you need to. How does that work, Rob?
So if you normally bring up here, I'll show you on my phone, see if we can get this to come up clearly. You bring up Find My Phone on an Android phone, and you get this nice little dialogue. Your browser is not currently supported. Sorry. So what you want to do is use this little request desktop site function.
There you go.
Can't tell my right from my left one. I have to look through the camera.
And that's just under settings.
Request desktop site, which sends a user agent string that suggests you're running Chrome on Linux. And in a moment. And now you have the usual sign into iCloud dialog.
Right.
The funny thing is if you go into Safari and on your Mac and you can activate the develop menu, which lets you change the user agent string, and you then send a user agent string suggesting you're using Chrome for Android, you get the Android browsers are not supported page. If you say that you're an iPhone, you get the page that has links to the App Store to download the Find My Phone app. And I think here there's some web developer at Apple who's working way too hard. You know, if I am trying to use Find My Phone on an Android phone, it's probably because, like my father-in-law, I bought an iPad or some other iDevice, and I would like to find it.
And
this is the device I have right now, so let me use it. Don't say the browser's not compatible when it does work just fine.
Right. And you had another interesting tip in the same column that had to do with getting pages to display a Chromecast button where they might not ordinarily do so. Does this work with any site that has video on the net? Am I getting that right?
Well, I hope it will. I hate every and any or one of those words you don't want to use in journalism because they almost guarantee having to run a correction. Where this came up, I was trying to watch ESPN.com to cast video from that to my Chromecast. And when you click on a video, it opens in this browser window where the address bar doesn't have the little Chromecast button at the far right of it. And there's no way to make that appear through Chrome's view menu. But
and the ordinary way that appears is because Chrome has partnered up with that entity, correct?
In this case, the nice thing about the way Chrome casting from the Chrome browser to Chromecast works, there's no permission involved. So this works with sites that have not shipped any kind of app and maybe don't want you to view their stuff online. That's not the case with Watch ESPN. This was just where it came up. Uh-huh. But yeah, if it's in your browser, you can put it on your TV. There is some processing overhead because your copy of Chrome has to encode everything that's coming down the web, re-encode it, then ship it out to the Chromecast so it can then play. So if you have an older laptop, it won't work so well. But in this case, yeah, suppose you wanted to watch some video from ESPN site and you don't have a phone or an iPad handy, no problem. You copy the address from the smaller window, paste it into the regular Chrome window, and then it appears with the Chromecast button. You click that, you're all set. And it's a nice end run around the way a lot of video sites would rather not make it too easy for you to watch on the larger screen in your house.
Yes. And we'll note that no DRM was broken in the process of giving these tips.
I hope. I mean,
I feel pretty certain that just simply using a different link or, you know, taking Justice Scalia's advice and exploiting a loophole.
Right.
Right. Let's go on to our resource of the week, which is in keeping with knowing what your politicians are doing with the money that they've been provided by whoever is given them money. A 16-year-old named, Nick Rubin, and our other resource aside from his Greenhouse app is going to be his Twitter page. He's Nick Rubin on Twitter. He wrote this app, and what it does is it's a plugin, a browser plugin that works, I think, with all major browsers. And when it sees the name of a politician, you hover your cursor over that name, and you get a little window that pops up. It's got the politician's name, their picture, and the industry that has given him money, him or her money, and the amount that has been given by that industry. This is all data coming from opensecrets.org, a great little tool. So you're reading a story, say, about how your congressperson voted on a healthcare-related issue, and you can look right away and see how much the healthcare industry has given that congressperson over the years. Great thing as we come into the election cycle here, and very nice thing for a 16-year-old to have accomplished. I haven't downloaded it yet. Rob, have you used this?
No, I have not. I mean, this is this based? I want to sort of throw this at a lot of Virginia politicians in my state. One of the funny things is companies can give money directly to politicians. You don't need to launder through a pack. You can just write a check. So it's always interesting to see who's gotten how much money from Dominion Power, Washington Gas, or any of the large tobacco companies you find based in Richmond. It would be fun to go on a fishing expedition with that.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not sure if it will work in Virginia politicians or not, but download it, kick the tires, and let us know what you think of the Greenhouse app. I think it's pretty cool.
Yes.
Guys, this has been really, really fun. A wonderful discussion. So informative and wide ranging. I appreciate so much for taking the time. Rob Peguero, great having you on. I know you're Thanks constantly running around. You were showing us before the show your stack of business cards that you're trying to scan and make useful use of because of all the places that you're constantly going and speaking or otherwise getting together, yes, with folks in the industry on important tech and policy issues. Anything particular on your plate that you want to let people know about to keep an eye out for?
Well, let's see. Yeah, smartwatches. I've got to figure out the rules of the road for when it's you're going to be a jerk using that. And, you know, well, obviously, I guess at some point we'll see an Apple smartwatch. That'll complicate the picture further. Let's see. I don't know. There's so many of the stories I'm working on involve security issues of one kind or another. So there's conferences coming up. I may try to get to attend that. Patent reform, it's not going to go away, although it seems dead in this particular Congress. You know, maybe we'll see enough outrageous evidence of people buying up patents that shouldn't have been issued in the first place. But that problem was obvious 2 years ago. The timetable, I've been following on Twitter the conversation about the phone unlocking thing. And yeah, the need for this kind of bill should have been obvious 5 years ago. So maybe that's the half-life of good tech policy getting enacted. Yeah, I think that's what's on the top of my head right now.
All right. Thanks so much for that.
Other things just because it's Friday, it's 4:30.
Well, send it to me and I'll put them in the discussion points for the show if you do think of anything else, which people can access at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/268 is our episode this time around. Latif Matima, so great to have you on once again. Hope you're enjoying the tail end of your summer here before the term starts again.
Yes, doing my best to power up for another year of reaching into young minds and trying to do something constructive. Other than that, you know, for me, the only major thing that I can think of that is coming up, I actually have a new book coming out. It is called Intellectual Property, Social Justice, and Entrepreneurship. And it is going to be published by Elgar Publications. And it should be out somewhere around the beginning of 2015. And so anyone who's interested in what that book is all about that you can't already tell from the title, you can always just drop me a note. You can find me on the Howard University Law School website. And I'll be happy to share information and updates and also add you to our institute's email list and provide, we try to provide every month updates on intellectual property and social justice developments, events, cases, and all the like. So that's what will be keeping me busy.
That book should be required reading in any incubator's common room, I would think. So we're looking forward to that coming out. Great topics to bring together in one book. It's been so wonderful chatting with you both. We really, really appreciate it. We appreciate everybody who's joined us this week for This Week in Law. We do the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, and try and bring you guests of this kind of caliber every single week. That's why it's so fun to do the show. If you've missed recording with us live, you can pick up the show at your leisure at twit.tv/twill. Also at This Week in Law on YouTube, or on Roku and in iTunes and all over the net. You'll find us out there. And the archive is available for your perusal, probably most easily at twit.tv/twill. What else should I let you know? You should get in touch with me between the shows, because that's how I find out about other great guests that we should have on the show to discuss these important topics with. You can email me at denise@twit.tv. You can send me a tweet. I'm at D Howell on Twitter. You can email Evan too, even though he wasn't here with us this week. He's Evan@twit.tv, and the show has pages at both Facebook and Google Plus and communities there. So if you need more than 140 characters, that would be a great public place to do it. Otherwise, you know, email is great. We love hearing from you. We get so many great suggestions for topics and feedback on our guests and additions to things that we've discussed on the show. So we really, really appreciate all that. Keep it coming, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.